This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good morning. You're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kinnison and Noelle Lim. It is 6 a.m. Monday, the 27th of July, and yet another month has flown by. How are you both doing today?
Yes, time really just goes by so quickly, right? So last week, I had quite a good break. I was in Penang, and that was quite a lovely time with my sister. And so, well, back to work this week.
How was Penang, actually?
Well, Penang is Penang. I haven't been back since like 5 years ago. You know, I'm not disparaging Penang. But I don't notice, you know, the SOPs, right? I think in KL, they seem much more stringent. I think the vendors and like retailers, they seem to follow SOPs much more strictly in KL. In Penang, I got the sense that it was a bit more relaxed there.
Yeah, it's not the first time I've actually heard this. I think it's quite a fragmented application of the SOPs there. But it seems like everyone is going to Penang. I have a few friends who are in Penang over this weekend. I know people are going to Penang this coming weekend. And it's the typical Klang Valley destination, right? You want to get out of KL. Where do you go? You go to, I was about to say the Klang Valley, sorry. You go to Penang. But yeah, I mean, good weekend, good week last week. Nothing really to... Oh, one thing of note, the English Premier League has come to an end.
Yes, I knew you had to insert that somewhere.
Of course. It'll be the last for some time, I think, because Game 38 was played yesterday, all the games at the same time. And United and Chelsea have made it into the top four, which means they qualify for the Champions League in some way or another. Leicester misses out on that, and so does Wolves. I was hoping that they would somehow qualify for it, because it's a little bit of that... smaller team, underdog sort of story. But yeah, the Premier League is over for the time being till September.
Is there a new hole in your life, Roshan Kinnison?
I mean, the pandemic got me used to that, because the Premier League was over. I haven't really watched any football since the pandemic started, because I never got used to the new schedule, and because the new schedule is every other day they were playing football, it was 3-4 a.m. our time. And considering that that's about the time that we get up to go to work,
it's just nice for you, right? Just wake up a bit earlier.
Nah. That means sleeping earlier, and I can't do that. But yeah, so that's a bit of sports. But F1 is still going on, so at least there's that.
At least there's that indeed. And of course, today we have lots of things lined up for you. Even in this hour, there are plenty of interesting things we're going to be discussing later on after the 6:30 news. What do we have?
Well, I'm not talking about global sports at 6:30. We're talking about other global stories, including the apparent first suspected case of COVID-19 in North Korea. Prime Minister Lee Hsien-Loong, Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien-Loong's announcement of his cabinet, and a bit of news coming out from our neighbours up north in Thailand.
All right, so that's happening after the 6:30 news. But in about 15 minutes, Noelle, what do we have?
Something about old buildings and the Catholics.
Okay, that's a very descriptive illustration of what's going to be happening later on at 6:15. If you want to weigh in on the conversation, you can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, whether or not you want to stream music to your brain. So stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Run Around by Blues Traveller, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noelle. Now, we're taking a look at the story this morning. It's talking about how, for Elon Musk's next trick, perhaps he's going to be streaming music directly to your brain. But no, actually, that's one of the probably most superficial uses of the Neuralink, which is what this article is talking about. What it basically is a chip that implants into your brain using kind of threads that are going to kind of insert into your brain and be able to read your brain's signals. Basically, Elon Musk is trying to take the next step into the world of human AI merging, basically. And it's an interesting kind of subject, because this isn't something that's come out of nowhere, of course. You know, this kind of research has existed for many years, particularly looking at how, at ways to perhaps allow people who have been paralyzed, who have experienced brain or spinal cord injuries, to regain some semblance of movement. So it could be that this Neuralink might get you a little bit closer to that. But the question is, you know, would you be interested in this kind of technology? Because Elon Musk, I guess for Elon Musk, this is his vision of the future.
I don't know, part of me feels like Elon Musk is trying to start Starfleet here from Star Trek, right? He's already building spaceships. He's already getting the battery technology all kind of sorted out. And now he's building chips to put into our brains to merge those two things together. I don't know. I'm getting goosebumps, and not the good type of goosebumps. Just the idea of putting a thread, threads that connect to my brain and a chip, just... They weird me out a little bit. But I, of course, with all things tech, there are benefits to it, right? So there are medical benefits, of course. They're looking to treat OCD with this, among other things. And then, of course, there's also that. Imagine if you could have the power of your phone in a chip to bring that synergy to your brain, to drop in a buzzword there. I mean, you'd be able to do advanced mathematics in a heartbeat, but the typical problems we have with tech would then apply to organic matter and yourself, and that's what worries me.
So it's obviously a very interesting development, and having Elon Musk putting money there, you know, obviously this technology will advance further. So what they're really doing is, you know, connecting sensory inputs like sound and visual to replace the role of nerves within our brain, right, in some sense. So I think the first question is, if someone is healthy and they have this chip inside them, does that mean that over time your nerves will become, you know, you don't use your, you know, those nerves that connect sensory input to your brain? I mean, how would that change your brain, actually? Because, you know, you're obviously going to be bypassing some signals.
Yeah, so that's another thing that also concerns me, right? Because your body also adapts to what it's given. And if your brain is used to getting this external stimuli, this chip basically running the processors and running the show, your brain's eventually going to... I wonder how that works out, because I have a pacemaker and my heart doesn't naturally pace itself anymore because it's gotten used to the fact that the pacemaker will sort the job out. Your body does that. It adapts to your environment and the things that you have supplemented and augmented it with. I don't want to be dependent on a piece of tech in my brain, because as it is, we're in 2020 and we have plenty of problems with tech. Tech has come a long way, but tell me, when's the last time your phone froze on you? Do you want that in your brain?
Yeah, so Microsoft chip perhaps, but okay, jokes aside. But really, I know, I think it's very helpful for people who may have hearing impairment and when, you know, can be a birth defect or can be an elderly person. And this technology can be extended to sight as well, and as well as movement.
Yeah, basically it could supplement perhaps a sense that's missing, right, for the ordinary human being. But Elon Musk has made some comments to the effect that he's ultimately looking to achieve some kind of symbiosis between human and artificial intelligence. And he's even said that, you know, even in the most benign of scenarios, humans would essentially be left behind. So it really sounds like he's trying to push the envelope on a new kind of evolved form of the human being.
Maybe he knows that the Terminators are eventually going to come here. And these are the this is the only way.
I think he's creating the new Terminators.
No, those are the other tech companies. He's creating the bionic human side of the situation. So eventually you're going to have a war between the Terminators created by some other big tech company which has access to all sorts of data, not naming any names here, and Elon Musk's own bionic humans who... that's a movie idea. Let's get that written down somewhere.
Yeah, so, and also this is, you know, widens the gap between the rich countries and poor countries, right? You know, countries who can afford this kind of technology, they're going to create this super powerful human being. And also, you know, things like how it will affect sports, for example. Can you allow a semi-machine to participate in sports and qualify for a gold medal? I'm just thinking of the runners from Africa, and now you're going to have this bionic man from America.
When you're talking about countries, then how does that apply to military, right? You're going to have different military applications, which then again will bring a whole different ballgame to the situation.
Yeah, basically there are a lot of ethical considerations that we haven't solved when it comes to present day technology, much less the kind of futuristic technology that Elon Musk is proposing.
Yes, such pleasant world ending talk at 6:14 a.m. in the morning.
We're very deep people.
Starting you off as we mean to go on a Monday morning. But do let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. We have some messages coming up for you, and then we're going to be talking about the old architecture and whether or not they should be refurbished, replaced, what should be done with it. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Four American Dollars by US Girls, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. 6:19 a.m, Monday the 27th of July. And now we're turning our attention to Vietnam, where despite protests, it appears that government officials are going to demolish a 135-year-old cathedral, the Bui Chu Cathedral. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. But why they're doing this is in order to make way for a larger replica of the cathedral instead. And this has obviously led to quite a lot of media furor, a lot of protests from heritage groups who say that this church, that this cathedral, which is widely considered to be the birthplace of Catholicism in Vietnam, that it should be preserved as a heritage site in order to it basically, rather than just destroying it and creating a new one instead.
Yeah, I'm a bit conflicted on this story, right? Because on one hand, you have an old building which is in a state of disrepair, and arguably it costs more money to restore it. So if you're already kind of strapped for cash, wouldn't you want to do the most optimal thing, which is to basically just demolish it and rebuild it? And it's sentiment, right? An attachment to this building. It's symbolic. It represents a lot. There is that push and pull, right, between end of the day, you still need to develop, new things will always come about, right? There's only so many old things that we can keep in play because they were built in a different time with different needs in mind. Maybe they're not big enough. Maybe they don't have the infrastructure that we need. After a certain amount of time, you have to kind of get rid of the old to make way for the new. But there's some buildings you should keep. Which ones? I don't know, because you want these to be symbolic and a reminder of the past, but you don't want them to be protected from basically from modernization.
I can understand why they may want to demolish this if the structure is found to be unsafe, you know, for anyone to just go in and use the church. But that doesn't seem to be the case, and there are probably some workaround solutions because this, I think, is probably quite an important monument, 135 years old, right? And, you know, time, you can never replace time with money, I think. And there are also other some values apart from, you know, preserving our nation, the nation's history, heritage. It's very important to know history because it shows how societies develop, how the country developed, and religion is one part of how we live as a society, right? And then, so that's that part. And there's also environmental concerns. You know, you tear down a building and you build another one, you use more materials. And how can you ever replicate this building? I'm just looking, it's so beautiful. And you know, to replicate those details, you got to bring in the artisans, right? There are a lot of details to be replicated in this building.
See, what boggles the mind slightly is that the church allegedly refused offers to alternatively buy land near the church for a new building to be constructed for parishioners to use, because this is a cathedral that is still in operation. And they also allegedly refused offers to refurbish the building. And these were offers made by private individuals. So I don't really understand the motivation behind that, if that's true, because I would think that, you know, for in a case like this, you know, Roshan, you were talking about certain buildings need to be preserved, right? I'm not saying every building needs to be preserved, otherwise we'll never advance. But certain ones like this that, you know, stand as a monument to a religion within the country, I think that there is a case to be made for this to be declared a heritage site. And if that's the case, you know, you can't replicate the techniques that were used to build this 135 years ago. You can't replicate the tools and the specific materials. You're going to do the best you can in all likelihood, but it's not going to be the same. So, you know, the historical value for me in a replica would be gone as compared to the original building. So it's a difficult balance to strike. I'm very curious as to the rationale behind this decision.
Yeah, but at the same time, right, maybe it's the rationale here is that they don't want two buildings, right? Even if you restore it and now you're building another building, another place, you've got now two cathedrals to maintain. That still costs money to do. You can build something, but maintaining it for, let's say, another 150 years, that's going to be an impact too. And operationally, it's going to be confusing. But at the same time, whenever it comes to heritage sites, I understand the emotive element of it. But when it comes to learning history, we're not back in a day where information could be destroyed when a book was burnt. Information today is abundant. In fact, maybe we have too much information.
Yes.
And a lot of it, a lot of it skeptically verified at this point. But you can have photos, you can have textbooks, you can have all sorts of ways to learn history. I mean, how many of us actually travel somewhere else to learn history? We learn history from books a lot of the time.
Yeah, so cognitively, we can learn history. Intellectually, we get it, oh, this is 135-year-old. But there's nothing like standing in front of a monument and really just, you know, by swept away by its beauty, right? You know, the Eiffel Tower, for example, there's nothing like seeing the actual Eiffel Tower. You can read about it. Yeah, it's beautiful. But when you see it, oh my God, this is like the most beautiful thing on earth. I mean, that's my point of view. And you know, in Malaysia, I don't think we have a very good track record in maintaining heritage buildings. I remember when Bok House was going to be brought down, there was a lot of protest from the heritage groups, the architects. And I remember the comments by one minister, oh, it's only a rich man's house. But it was designed by one of the best architects in his time, in his generation.
Yeah, so I guess it comes down to people's priorities, I suppose, right? For me, you know, when I go into a building that's 200-300 years old, what strikes me is the idea that how many thousands of people have, you know, walked over the same steps that I'm walking over right now. There is a gravity to that for me. But I guess, you know, that's not something that everyone appreciates. So, there are going to be many sides to this argument wherever you place it. But let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. We have the 6:30 news bulletin coming up for you. But first, Human by The Pretenders. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was This Love Affair by Gloria Gaynor, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanison and Noelle Lim. 6:39 a.m, Monday the 27th of July. We've been talking about a number of interesting things. Cheryl has WhatsApped us to talk in response to our discussion over what should be done with old buildings. He says they should be restored, so just like how the Europeans would do, particularly in the case of this Vietnamese cathedral. He said that knowing it's a cathedral, people will likely donate. So it's a good point. Continue to let us know what you think. We are continuing our look at international stories this morning, particularly over at North Korea, which has reported its first suspected coronavirus case.
Its first suspected COVID-19 case. Amazing.
I know. You know, it's been how many months since COVID-19 really blew up? And all this time, you know, there have been suspected cases in North Korea. But the problem is that their media is so tightly state-controlled that nothing's really come through. It's been impossible to verify any of these claims. But now they have said that someone who defected from North Korea to South Korea about 3 years ago has returned to the North carrying COVID-19.
Yeah, so you know what? This is what happens. You close your borders, or you're very selective in allowing who to come in. You can naturally control the situation quite well. And bear in mind, this is what the state media had reported. There was someone who defected, right? So mind you, this is a warning sent to all North Koreans. Don't try that defection because you might come back again with COVID-19.
Yeah, and then I think also this illustrates like, okay, well, let's just, I mean, take all this information with a grain of salt. It also, I think, emphasizes the point that a lot of times, if you're a closed economy, so North Korea, it may be realistic as a closed economy with not much imported people moving in and out, that COVID-19 was minimal or non-existent there until the import case was brought in. But I think this is the point here, is that the big risk now, as we've all locked down our countries and looked at different ways of managing the situation, the biggest risk is the cases that come in. And now, I think, was it in Malaysia last week, they announced that we're going back to that mandatory 2-week quarantine if you come back from overseas, because there were stories of people who were just flagrantly ignoring the home quarantine, just blatantly irresponsible with their going to gyms and partying and things like that. And it's... that's the biggest risk, right? I think that there was some news that if we hit 3 digits again, we're looking at some different version of the MCO, and that's going to cost all of us money, everybody here in this country.
Yeah, with North Korea particularly, there are also concerns that if they do have a COVID-19 outbreak, if it's true that they haven't had any confirmed cases up until this point, the concern over whether or not their healthcare system will hold up is still present, because North Korea's healthcare system is not the most advanced in the world, and the fact that they are so isolated means that it will be difficult to get things like PPEs in and out. Whether or not the government will even accept it is another question. But of course, speaking of governments, we also did have some news out of a southern neighbour of ours. Singapore, because Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong has announced his new cabinet in a reshuffle that will see changes in ministers for 6 out of his 15 ministries. So it's an interesting lineup he has here, including a couple of promotions. So Dr. Maliki Osman, who's a former senior minister, has been promoted now to minister in the Prime Minister's office. And Edwin Tong is also now Minister for Culture, Community and Youth.
Yeah, so some of the names to look out for, obviously, is Mr. Heng Swee Keat. He still remains as DPM and with an enlarged portfolio on looking into economic packages and all that. And also Ong Ye Kung, who is also part of the 4G leadership. He used to head up Education Ministry. Now he's been moved to Transport. Honestly, I'm not sure whether that's a downgrade or just a change of portfolio. I mean, I would think that Education Ministry is huge, right? And oftentimes you need to take a long-term view. But I think changes are, you know, probably always a good thing. And then I think, like, you know, some other changes. Mr. Edwin Tong, he replaces Grace Fu as Minister for Culture, Community and Youth. And yeah, so I think the point here is Prime Minister Lee is trying to say, you know, provide some continuity by giving ministers different exposure as they take on this 4G leadership.
Yeah, and I think there's still, there was a bit of concern from the last election about the performance of Heng Swee Keat, right? Because he is, for all intents and purposes, they are the next Prime Minister, basically. It's the DPM post. He's been pushed to that position. A lot of emphasis on it. And
he's the anointed successor.
He's the anointed successor. Yes, let's go with that terminology. But there was a lot of, I think, disappointment, or not disappointment, but they were concerned among the DPMs and the senior ministers. He didn't perform as well as some others. But then again, he probably had a much harder seat as well.
Yeah, this is in terms of the general elections, as in not performance as a minister.
Sorry, yes. In terms of the vote that he got during the election they had 2 weeks ago, was it at this point?
Yeah, it was about 2 weeks ago. But the weird thing was that his party chose to move him from his existing seat, which wasn't something that they'd ever done with any other deputy prime minister.
It's such a high profile,
person. So they probably, you know, considered him a big gun. They moved him into a seat that they really needed the vote in order to not lose that GRC. He unfortunately didn't perform very well because I think there were a couple of gaffes in early speeches during the campaign period. So yeah, I mean the fact that he is still here as Deputy Prime Minister, in the Deputy Prime Minister position, does indicate some level of continuity. But I do wonder whether or not we'll see any further reshuffles in the future.
Yeah, so I think Senior Minister Tharman Shanmugaratnam, he would still be there, you know, providing a very strong advisory role. I think people do hope that he would be given a larger role. But I suppose, you know, if you are sort of retiring in a cabinet together with Lee Hsien Loong, the best you can do is to mentor younger ministers.
Yeah, and I mean, if that's the case, going back to Swee Keat, that if he was, I mean, he was moved, he did his job, right? He was supposed to, he was moved to a more important seat, and that he won the seat, even if it's by a lower majority. The fact is that it was a more difficult thing to do for him. I mean, it's easier to win in a seat that you have been running at before this.
Yeah, so there is a lot of concern focused on the new cabinet. But do let us know what you think. You can WhatsApp us 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. We have some messages coming up for you. And then we're looking at the front pages of the newspapers. So stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Don't You Want Me by Human League, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. Now we have a WhatsApp in from an anonymous listener asking, why would anyone want a chip in their brain? This anonymous listener says that they just don't get it.
Yep, I don't get it either. No, I understand. I understand the allure of it, the advances that you could go forward. It's kind of just like, why would you go on the internet and put your information, right? Sometimes it's just that competitive feel. If everyone else is getting a chip in their brain and you want to compete at that same level, you might need to put a chip in your brain. I just want to be able to take it out whenever I want.
Yeah, when it came to, I mean, all of the recent reports have been about chip users being able to stream music directly into their brains, right? And I just imagine a whole new generation of frustrated parents arising as a result of this. We do have, nevertheless, a number of newspapers in front of us with lots of very interesting local stories. What do we have in the New Straits Times, Noel?
Yeah, so the New Straits Times, on their headlines, MCO may be reimposed if cases reach 3 digits, like in the hundreds. Singapore, for example, is like still recording 400 plus, 500 plus, 300 plus. So so basically, this is really a warning from Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri Yaakob, the senior minister for security cluster. He says, you know, if people don't comply and if cases go up, and especially those who are returning from overseas, and if they don't comply with all the SOP procedures of doing the swabs, they will have to, you know, take harder, a sterner action. So the NST also spoke to infectious disease consultant Dr. Christopher Lee on when, you know, what should be the criteria in determining whether the MCO should be reimposed. And he says it really depends on how widespread the clusters were. I think we've done quite a good job in containing them. So I think it's a question of how, you know, how viral this this infection is. And then only then you decide whether it should be a localized or limited EMCO or something more nationwide.
Yes, so I have the Star in front of me, and their headline is Construction Sector's Desperate Cry for Help, but Government Takes Firm Stance. So this is a story that is spread over pages 4 to 7 of the Star. But the picture here on the front page, it's a little bit hard to recognize the figures involved, but actually it is the foreign minister, Dr. Sri Hishamuddin Hussein, bumping fists with the foreign minister of Singapore, Dr. Vivian Balakrishnan, on the causeway, because, of course, Malaysia and Singapore cross-border travel has been okayed, to use the word that the Star used, because a lot of, I think, a lot of Malaysians and Singaporeans work, travel across the causeway on a daily basis, and up until this point, that causeway has been closed. So it looks like the foreign ministries have made some headway.
Yes, I like that, you know, it looks very social and very friendly, right? So the question, when they go back to their respective countries, do they need to, you know, quarantine in a hotel?
Yeah,
for 14 days.
I don't know. That is a good question.
Or are they going to be exempted?
Are they going to be maybe they'll be the first people to take advantage of this cross-border travel being okayed?
I've got the Malaysian Reserve. Just switching topics a little bit. We've got a bit of the sidebar is here about pent up demand for. This is from Battersea Power Station. So this is a London property development, and they're saying that pent up demand is coming back. There is pent up demand for properties. This demand is slowly coming back. So a bit positive there, I guess. But more importantly, if I flip over through the pages, I'm paying attention to page 5 of the Malaysian Reserve. Goldman agrees to a 16.7 billion settlement case with Malaysia over one MDB case. Now, the highlights here is that Goldman Sachs has basically settled, I think, a 2.9 billion amount with the government. 3.9 in total. But if you break it up, 2.4 is what they will pay, and the other 1.5 is guaranteed. They guarantee that the assets held by the US government will be returned. So it's a guarantee. So at the end of the day, they're only footing 2.9 billion. But I think, long story short, Goldman will be quite happy to get this off their books and off their radar for a while, because I still remember, I think it was on the breakfast grill 2 years ago when then finance minister told the world that Malaysia was going to take legal action against Goldman Sachs. And that was, I mean, how the scale of it, who knows where that would have gone, but it's not exactly a pretty picture when a sovereign nation sues a bank.
And we're going to be talking about this in more detail later on at about 7:15 with comments from P. Gunasegaram, Editor-in-Chief of Focus Malaysia. So be sure to stay tuned. We are about to head into the 7 o'clock hour, a.k.a. the serious side of the morning run. So be sure to stay tuned. But first, we have the news bulletin coming up for you and The Vines with Ride, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.